You're listening to Enthusiasts, a podcast about the most passionate of passionate people. Link in episode description to check out the back catalog, learn more about the show, and check out my other show, 17 Karat K-Pop. This series of episodes tackles themes including depression, suicide, and substance abuse. Please take care when listening, and know the help is out there. Visit NAMI.org, N-A-M-I. Receive more localized support through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, 1-800-662-4357. You could also call to talk anytime to a suicide crisis hotline, 1-800-273-8255. Don't want to call? You can text someone. Get 24/7 crisis counselor support, 741-741. You're listening to a series of episodes about the life and legacy of Tony Hsieh. I highly recommend you check out the past parts of this story if you haven't yet. The link is in the episode description. Enjoy the show! So I have to do an aside now about Howard Hughes' fascinating life. Hughes turned his massive inheritance into an even bigger multi-billion-dollar fortune through real estate, film production, even an airline. So it's interesting, actually, Tony once noted Zappos Airlines might be a thing someday. It never was, but it was an idea he had floated. Hughes bought tons of Vegas property to revitalize it, a bunch of undeveloped land, 6 casinos, enough to equal 1/3 of the strip's yearly revenue, an airport terminal, a TV station, so much. Which is why Councilman Bob Coffin said, "This is basically what Tony's doing. He's the Howard Hughes of our day. He will help us out like Hughes did in the 60s recession." And Tony was actually spending more, $350 million. Hughes acquired property totaling approximately $300 million. He became Nevada's largest employer in just 4 years. A very unexpected twist, though. Hughes did all this while a hermit, an OCD-affected introvert who never left his place. So he bought basically a whole town without leaving his penthouse suite. And he left Vegas 4 years after arriving. So he showed up, spent a fortune from his hotel room, and left without participating in what he'd created. I would so not be surprised if he had been autistic too. There actually is some overlap between autism and OCD-affected people, as am I, but I digress. He definitely had that Tonyism, where he wanted to make big moves, but he didn't necessarily need or want credit and adulation for it. He was fine with packing up and leaving before people could make him into a celebrity. Another interesting aside, this gas station owner found Hughes on the side of a road, gave him a ride to Vegas. Then shortly after Hughes' death, a man left an envelope with this gas station owner, saying it was from Hughes, and it was a will. But the court later deemed that will was invalid. The owner never asked for anything like that, and never tried really to get the money. The DTP, in the short term, seemed to be really working. What a thriving, fascinating experience and experiment. However, there were many concerns that grew with time, because Tony's tendencies, the lean-in, move-fast-and-break-things tendencies, the holacracy-type, skirt-responsibility, pass-the-buck attitude, the everyone-for-themselves mentality, and the constant conscious effort to stay happy, that all affected people in many negative ways. Actually, Vegas does statistically have a disproportionately high number of suicides compared to other major U.S. cities. There's a lot of despair there with the pressure to be happy and a partier all the time. One of the big critiques was the lack of support after a project got off the ground. Tony took kind of a Jeff Bezos strategy that was hands-off. Bezos maybe was less hands-off, actually. But when the sale to Amazon happened, it did not change Zappos. Bezos had acquired it, but then basically let them keep running day-to-day operations the same. He's done that with Washington Post, too. He buys stuff and then kind of just lets other people handle it still. But anyway, so Tony would invest in DTP startups and then say go nuts and not follow up. So Jen's business, factorially, quickly fell into financial precarity. When a reporter went to this city to see factorially for a story in July, that reporter then confirmed by that September it was shuttered. There were crossed wires regarding its financial status. Not a clear line of communication about that. Not everyone on the same page aware of how much was being made versus spent. Some people also critiqued where the money was going, and that it was delegated to a bunch of Tony's friends and recruits who had moved there. So the people who already lived there, they were SOL. Remember earlier when I brought up one of the first big summaries of the effects of gentrification? Part one, quirky outsiders and artists come to an area, they redo it in their image, but then other people show up, then put their own stamp on the town, and then the original people are kind of devalued and kicked out. So Vegas did have, much like Park City, Utah, in its recession days, they still had people there that could be called a ghost town, washed up, worn down, never recovering. But no, culturally, there were still those embers. There was still music and art locally that could have flourished if it had the right funding. This is a common criticism of a lot of startups, the thought of how much good your money could do if it didn't go to building something from scratch, but just went into helping bolster something that already put down roots. And they didn't do that. Someone pitched Tony this messaging platform idea for DTP members, and Tony did not invest, wasn't interested, which threw him for a loop, because he was like, a way to stay in touch and connect? Isn't that the core of this project that doesn't interest you? There were also efforts to highlight local musicians at the DTP-sponsored festival-type events. Those requests went ignored. Big ramifications happen that Tony will later admit to regretting the handling of. This is a time where I want to remind you of him being autistic because I see this from a different perspective, maybe less judgmental than most, because we can get into a mode of thinking that's just very analytical and doesn't really factor in emotional toll. That's what he did here when literally people were kicked out. So of these homes he bought up, some people ended up kicked out on the street. They did try to give a heads up to people who were to be evicted, but that backfired because when word got out about the evictions, people realized, oh, major renovations are coming for that area. So the property values in the soon to be invested heavily in community skyrocketed. Fun fact, Walt Disney made sure this kind of thing didn't happen. He wanted to make sure stayed anonymous because he worried about the effects if he had made public the news that he was about to invest in an area. Then all the prices might go up around that area. He didn't want to do that. He wanted to keep it secret. Maybe that would have been the way to go. Amy Groth, who wrote a book about her experience in the DTP as a journalist who lived amid the action, recalls how Jen described Tony's attention as that laser beam, focused on you, making you feel like the center of the world, and she noted how that laser beam moved away to its next target. When an idea didn't work, they scrapped it. The laser didn't return there. Della Rucker wrote a really good lengthy piece about her career, basically, in community revitalization work. I'll link to it with my other sources, as always. It's called The Long Hard Slog of Revitalization. And she points out how a 5-year time frame to transform a place is ridiculously short. And it's way more complex and a layered investment requiring, not financially, but emotionally, investment requiring job to renovate a place and its deeper sense of community. Some of the key quotes from the essay, 2 or 3 years flow under the bridge before the general public starts to see a difference. The first years are spent doing crucial and grindingly unexciting work. More money can make the physical cleanup go faster. It can allow an organization to grab the obvious low-hanging fruit more quickly, but it can do very little to speed up the relationship building process. If you think that a downtown revitalization organization can single-handedly undo all these damages in less time than a car lease, I can only assume that you've never actually worked in a real disadvantaged urban place with real disadvantaged urban people. Money isn't the biggest issue. Deep, trustful partner relationships are. When you don't attract the hero worship or the hero hatred, it's a little harder to get the national media to see that you exist. Publications give us this kind of coverage of complex urban revitalization projects because they don't think we can or want to understand the full breadth and complexity of what it actually takes to make a difference in a struggling community. This stuff is complicated. The deep damage is what it tells us, the readers. You can't really fix these problems. Even the superhero couldn't do it. Gifts are fine if your objective is to make immediate solutions to immediate needs. But if you're serious about building a deep, substantive, sustainable transformation, we should know by now that throwing money at it will create no more than temporary surface change. Unquote. Indeed, there were a ton of cosmetic changes without the same sense of commitment to deeper senses of changing community trust, openness. Tony really did try to crowdsource values and analyze what would make his employees happy, but he didn't do the same outreach and analysis for locals. Instead, he treated this area like he entered a blank slate, a template for another exciting project to be built on. Another big criticism, besides gentrification concerns, harassment. Some of Tony's influences were distasteful, to put it mildly. Like everything in life, he liked to analyze the art behind different behavior, public speaking, comedy, etc. So he also studied flirting in a similar manner. He liked a book called The Game, which has lots of tips on how to seduce women. A famous pickup artist wrote it, Neil Strauss, although later he kind of tried to distance himself from The Game and its influence on young men. He liked some of those ideas, as well as those in MAC Tactics, The Science of Seduction Meets the Art of Hostage Negotiation. The author, Chris Curtis, went on to lead the Downtown Rangers, a group of vigilantes who were hired to patrol the streets of downtown Vegas as part of the DTP. So your nighttime escort was the author of MAC Tactics, which describe a MAC as something you do nice for a woman so that she has to repay you with something, so that she owes you something in the future. And it has instructions on things like getting past no. And says, quote, every interaction with a female is an opportunity. Unquote. Yet he won Officer of the Year. Some of these issues were not raised because Tony's circle was different. He kind of had a good cop, bad cop relationship, a yin and yang, with his Venture Frog and Link Exchange co-workers. But with the DTP, he wasn't just with co-workers. He was with the co-workers so loyal to him, so taken by the way he could laser beam focus and invest in you, show a belief in your potential, that they moved to Vegas for him. So the only people around now saw him as this hero, this Howard Hughes character, who could revitalize the city and change their lives, even if he seemed unassuming and introverted in some ways. So no one was saying no to him or his ideas. They didn't want to risk losing funding or moral support. An auto repair shop owner, nicknamed Gino, had his building bought by Tony's real estate partners, and they refused to renew his lease. He said, quote, it's like a religion you can't stop. The young Zappos crowd walked past his former shop, sorry, this is a different quote from the article, talking about new projects in which he has no role, unquote. A former employee wrote on the site Glassdoor, quote, very cult-like. Managers wanted to see how you interact with other employees to see how loyal you are to the company. I feel like you really have to drink the Kool-Aid to make it through training, unquote. Amy Groth, when writing her book, even researched a cult checklist, looking into what that might entail, and had the audacity to send that checklist to Tony, who replied, conceding to one of the 9 things on the list. He then pointed out, well, you could say the same for places like Apple, too. They probably check a lot of those boxes, too. Throughout podcast and article reporting, the word cult has come up countless times and felt very symbolized by Tony's 40th birthday party, where your invite was agreeing to a tattoo. So you couldn't go to the party unless you joined in getting this pixel-themed tattoo. Tony now walked around with an entourage, so to get time with him, you really had to squeeze it into his schedule, and probably it would not be one-on-one. People were always pitching to him. He had a big wall of sticky notes, so you write down your giant genius idea and put it on a note, slap it on the wall, and he might get back to you. So he was super informal and seemingly approachable, yet now he had an entourage. And you couldn't have time to schedule a meeting in a formal office because he worked out of the bar. There were a couple of major scathing letters written to Tony. One was from DTP member Chase Adams upon leaving the whole Zappos DTP world. Skipping around a bit, these are all quotes from that letter. Lack of vision, direction. It feels like there are 10 people at the helm, and none of the 10 is our CEO. I believe we've proven we can make customers happy for a while, but the employees' happiness is at an all-time low. I believe we disenfranchised the community with a lofty vision statement at its inception. Paul Carr wrote a very scathing takedown called Holacracy of Dunces. He argued they were moving the goalposts on defining success of the DTP. Paul had actually been approached by Tony earlier with a six-figure offer to write a book about him, but he declined. He says Tony stopped returning his calls once negative DTP coverage was no longer abnormal. He opens the essay with a Lord of the Flies quote, "Where's the man with the megaphone?" The fair boy shook his head. "This is an island. At least I think it's an island. That's a reef out in the sea. Perhaps there aren't any grown-ups anywhere." So here's some direct quotes from deeper in the essay. "Even the kids in Lord of the Flies took half a dozen chapters before they started jabbing each other with spears. At Zappos, the problems started almost immediately." He then cited nearly 100 startups got funding from Tony and partners and asked about what companies were particularly well off financially, to which Tony said about 3, then later jumped in, adding a 4th he thought of later in the phone call. When asked specifically how many decided to not commute to work but live right in DTP, he said, "I don't know," which is honestly possible, but I guess he wasn't invested in that number. Paul recounts a time, a week before a funding round closed, that his company was going to be short on payroll. Quote, "Our relationship was already strained, but the company's advisors all agreed that as our lead investor, Shea would surely be willing to extend a small loan to make sure everyone on the team got paid. Instead, he suggested we try to close our new round sooner. Every entrepreneur who has lived the gap from yes to cash knows what a punch in the gut that is." Shea then invited a member of his entourage into the room and asked me to repeat my tale of woe. After I'd humiliated myself for a second time, Shea asked the interloper, "What do you think I should do?" "I think you should give them the loan," came the reply. "Then why don't you give them the loan?" said Shea. After half an hour more of this, it became clear that Shea wasn't going to give us the loan. But nor was there a bad cop on hand to say no. It's ironic that the closest I've come to tears in my professional life was in a meeting with the author of Delivering Happiness, unquote. The responses to criticisms were not all-encompassing nor restoring faith. One response Tony would bring up are stats, like, hey, they argue this percent of businesses are in the hole, but they're not focusing on how this percent of businesses are thriving. He wanted to look on the positive. He also insisted on patience, that they're not done with the project yet, give it more time to see the results. And he asserted his view of leadership as hands-off. He described it as like he was a greenhouse. He wanted to let other people find their own ways to grow, be their own plants. He just gave them tools to do so. He later disavowed the mayor of downtown Vegas nickname, saying, "Look, you're putting unfair expectations on me. I can't fix a whole city's issues. I'm not that superhero that can save the day, so don't blame me when it goes wrong." When asked if he would do stuff differently, Tony told CNBC he would first of all focus on increasing foot traffic to the area earlier. Second of all, they would have clarified less broad goals from the get-go. And third, he would favor collisions more than the other C's, like co-learning and connectedness. He said, quote, "We never wanted to create Zappos Town. It's about creative and entrepreneurial people moving to downtown in general," unquote. He said in a separate interview, quote, "My role is about unleashing what people already have inside them. That is maybe suppressed in most work environments," unquote. His job was to facilitate not to see the after part of a before and after process is kind of where his mindset was. City officials seemed on board too, with Councilman Bob Coffin, the one who compared him to Howard Hughes, saying, quote, "I don't expect him to run a charity. I hope he runs a nice tidy profit from his investments, because he's brought a lot of spirit and confidence back to the city. I don't think his motives matter. This is the last town to say, we don't know if what you're doing is right," unquote. In 2012, Tony spoke at a summit called the Conscious Capitalism CEO Summit. Besides him, one speaker on the lineup really captivated Brian Robertson, who was a main proponent of Holacracy. Tony was taken by his story about a time he had steered a plane solo and realized how many issues with the plane might have been flagged sooner if junior employees had been given the same amount of voice to raise concerns as higher-ups. The thought of, what if it's not about majority rule, but everybody shares and spreads the power equally, so there's not just one person in charge, that really appealed to him. So rather than try to change course with the DTP, fix what it was not getting right, Tony decided to kind of start over and overhaul once again, with those new holocratic views spinning in his mind. Maybe this was the solution and a way to change all the bad parts of this project. The final months of the startup EcoMom were really bleak. An accountant, Philip Prentice, did kind of a post-mortem on the company and found a lot of red flags. First of all, it never turned a profit. It was always losing money. The sales were just too nice. The discounts were too constant. Quote, for every additional $60 average order shipped, our variable cost is $89 and we lose $29. Said another way, the more we sell, the more we lose. Said another way, if we cut all our sales to zero and sat around and played ping pong all day, we could continue to pay ourselves handsomely for 2 more years, while at the current sales rate, we'll be out of cash in 3 months. Said another way, now would be a very good time to pull the fire alarm, unquote. Post-Black Friday, sales cratered, and by the time it seemed like everyone got the memo that they had to change course, it was too late. They didn't seem to have anyone with super focused financial savvy who had set up a long-term budgeting plan for them. EcoMom then dropped the big discount strategy that was actually losing them money, but sales dropped as a result, so they had a bunch of unsold inventory, so yeah, their wasted money was another issue. Prentice recalled overhearing lots of desperate fundraising calls from Jody Sherman. But, quote, I would bring the financial statements to Jody, who had glanced at them so cursorily and waved me away with, no one can understand this without extensive analysis. Critically, he did not understand margin. At the end of December, when things were getting truly desperate, he said to me, Phil, just bring me a forecast that shows how much we need to sell to break even. He did not understand after 3 years of negative margin that increased sales resulted in increased losses. He had built his house by raising money, and when times got tough, he went with what he knew, unquote. Jody Sherman seemed to eventually just give up trying to financially salvage this place, saying things in their last few meetings like, it's okay, and let's just not keep it going. Fatalistic stuff. January 23rd, Jody sent an email hoping to vent and suggesting staff meet up regularly. If you wanted something like that, you had to organize it yourself. Quote, each of us is so busy and has so much on our plates. Oftentimes I find myself with no one to talk to about the challenges I might be facing, unquote. This also was around the time Jody's firing was a rumor, imminent firing. And people expressed interest in going to this first monthly meetup to vent. Jody did not live to see the first meeting come to fruition. January 28th, news spread, Joni was found dead in his car. He had taken his own life. 2 weeks later, EcoMom filed for a bankruptcy alternative called an assignment for benefit of creditors. Tony's mind was elsewhere. There was a big party to plan that featured life-size versions of games, the Jabberwockies performing. Tony was also in a new relationship that year, at least one. He was interested and open to polyamory. He got to know Alexandria Bevilacqua, an actress who played a Blue Man Group robot. Besides this big party, there was another all-hands meeting/pep rally in November. This one included a big Lion King performance and someone getting to win a $250 gift card if they climbed into the tarantula container. Parties, a new relationship, and he spent the second half of the year securing training seminars with Holacracy 101 guy Brian Robertson. Zappos was going to be the first company with over 1,000 employees to implement this. With views in mind like what Brian said, quote, your responsibility is not to support the people, but to protect the process, unquote. So what Tony viewed as another new project to move on to, other people saw it as a way to totally throw aside responsibility for past tragedies. And newly affiliate his project with only happy, good memories and public images. Also notable about 2013, the Reddit co-founder Aaron Schwartz, who was also quite brilliant, at age 14, he created RSS, took his own life. He wrote in a blog about feeling ashamed of depression. The following years were full of soul searching for Silicon Valley people, startup people, and the culture they were in, and how to address the elephant in the room of everybody saying we're happy, 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 while people are committing suicide. And two more suicides were about to occur by DTP members. Tony sent a lengthy email to staff announcing the official transition to Holacracy. He requested that they take 30 minutes to read that email, which also included two additional articles he wanted them to read. And he started off with a Henry Ford quote, "If everyone is moving forward together, then success takes care of itself." The implementation of a holocratic system was taking too long. So his new message was, after a dipping your toe into holocracy approach, to stop it. As he put it, a rip the band-aid off moment. Skipping around, but these are all direct quotes from that email. "We've been operating partially under holocracy and partially under the legacy management hierarchy. Having one foot in one world while having the other foot in the other world has slowed down our transformation towards self-management and self-organization. We haven't made fast enough progress towards more efficient structures. We are going to take a rip-the-band-aid approach to accelerate progress towards becoming a teal organization, as described in the book Reinventing Organizations. Holacracy just happens to be our current system to help facilitate our move to self-organization, and is one of many tools we plan to experiment with and evolve with in the future. In order to eliminate the legacy management hierarchy, there will effectively be no more people managers. In addition, we will begin the process of breaking down our legacy siloed structures/circles. Functions that were previously siloed will be embedded inside these business-centric circles instead. To be clear, managers were absolutely necessary and valuable to the growth of Zappos over the years under our previous structure. Without managers, we would not have gotten to where we are today. The people management aspects of the manager role are valuable in what the book refers to as orange and green organizations, but do not make sense in a self-organized and self-managing teal organization. All former managers who remain in good standing will keep their salary, even though the day-to-day work that formerly involved more traditional management will need to change. A new circle called Reinventing Yourself has been created to help guide former managers to new roles. For better context, please read the articles below. I won't read verbatim the articles he linked to, but I will summarize them for you. One is Frederic Laloux's Misperceptions of Self-Management. He makes the case for self-managing organizations by arguing that it's just nature, the natural, organic way humans progress. Organisms have just changed on their own, being their own bosses. Sort of an evolutionary, time immemorial, humans have been self-organizing approach. And he argues that there's more creativity as a result of lacking rigidity in roles. The misperceptions he lists include that this means self-managing has no structure and is about empowerment. He actually says, no, self-managing systems are about not needing power, not needing empowerment at all. These values employees seek out, they only seek out because they feel lacking. They need a sense of empowerment. Whereas in self-managing systems, it's just sort of baked in that you have those things. Remember back when Tony said integrity was not a main value, maybe a meta value, like so implicitly obvious it was not worth dwelling on at all. So the view was kind of live and let live, your sense of purpose, that stuff will come to you naturally. So there's no sense of needing an equal distribution of power, because power will naturally be dispersed as new roles become relevant, new tasks pop up, you just sort of let things play out as they may. The other article is Doug Kirkpatrick's Five Crucial Competencies of Self-Management. These things include taking initiative, tolerance for ambiguity, consciousness, contribution, mindset, and low power, distance sensitivity, in which he means there is still a hierarchy on the job, but it's a hierarchy based on tasks and traits, not on people and their sense of worth. It's rethinking rather than doing away with a hierarchy in a way, a ranking. Tony's letter acknowledges a couple of interesting points. One being that front-facing titles would have to stay official and professional to meet their obligations as a public company. So you might have to still say you're manager of blah blah blah. He also acknowledged the role confusion or dissonance people might feel by saying, yeah, this new system, self-management meets holacracy, a mix of ideals I've pieced together based on reading and speakers that I admire. This unique strategy, it won't be for everybody. So you are welcome to leave with a generous buyout. A buyout over 200 ended up taking. To get the buyout, you had to be in good standing, read this book by Frederick Laloux, or email him a statement of non-intention to read. Not sure what that is. You also had to give notice by the end of April, watch a Laloux YouTube speech, and make sure your responsibilities were smoothly passed on to someone else to take over. Tony compared their next chapter as a company to building an airplane while you're already trying to fly it. So it's going to be chaotic. He was ready for it. And said, quote, I'm personally excited about all the potential creativity and energy of our employees that are just waiting for the right environment and structure to be unlocked and unleashed, unquote. He was very excited for this, a word choice to keep in mind for later. For the reasons detailed previously in this series, some people did not vibe at all with Holacracy, or Tony's version of it. They struggled and didn't want to not be told what to do. Some people didn't want to self-control, self-regulate, be their own boss, feel on their own. They also didn't know what to do and who to turn to with questions or for advice, mentorship. Responsibility fell entirely on the individual, making it ironic that this was part of the whole communal biggest co-learning city in the world project. Although Tony would later argue that the Zappos culture was never meant to be the Vegas culture, like it was two separate projects, the DTP and Zappos. So there was cognitive dissonance with your assigned roles and sense of true responsibility, and with your sense of, am I part of Zappos world or the DTP? I thought it was both. It was all very undefined. Those who didn't like this system complained that their veto power was gone. So stupid ideas they had to hear out again and again because communication pathways were no longer there. So when your idea doesn't have to go through a chain of command, it is pitched again and again to people, to subgroups who hadn't been informed that idea had already been shot down in a different subgroup meeting. So a lot of time was wasted on ideas that were already rejected elsewhere. There were communication fissures for sure. There are also people who didn't like how it seemed like Tony didn't take on the responsibility that came with his influence. But he insisted, quote, it's not about avoiding conflict. It's about integrating multiple perspectives. Part of the reason why I'm drawn to Holacracy is that the processes enable multiple perspectives to be integrated without one side losing and the other side winning, or a lone voice being outvoted by the boss. Separate from that, the fewer decisions I can make, the faster the organization can move. Otherwise, I become one of the bottlenecks, unquote. So he framed being a boss as actually just getting in the way of employees, slowing them down, any trace of bureaucracy he viewed as an obstacle worth averting. Some people maybe were open to Holacracy, but expressed to reporters confusion over why he was so bent on doing this. It's not like Zappos or DTP ever needed a massive cultural reset in this way, maybe communally, but in terms of workflow, they were productive, or at least had potential paths to be productive. Zappos certainly did. Why not course correct in different ways, fixing parts that were broken rather than move fast, break things, and ignore what you broke? Some people thought it was just about assertiveness lacking in him. The desire to not have to do anything a boss does. Have big, uncomfortable meetings, break uncomfortable news, have a don't look at me way to manage stuff. Others, though, noted the ironic other impulse he has to make big, buzzy moves, and his constant love of poker games, fascination with studying theories about work culture, observing people, and then trying to place big bets on big shifts in dynamics. This was like another puzzle he wanted to shift the pieces of to see how the picture would change. The Wall Street Journal heard from some Zappos employees that actually enjoyed the change. It wasn't universally loathed. One shuttle bus driver talked about how relieved the driver felt to finally feel encouraged to speak up about persistent issues on the bus that had been bugging them, and not taking forever for his complaint to go through all these communication channels or like a game of telephone. Another woman recalled she was having, quote, more time for a workplace diversity committee and to perform on the Zappos dance team, unquote. One person prior to this, though, when they were entertaining Holacracy, but not fully yet, but someone who struggled with their sense of do-it-yourself life, was Ovik Banerjee. Ovik was bounced around quite a bit in terms of his assignments. He kept getting reassigned and eventually was tasked with the Learning Village curriculum. There was going to be an official school within the DTP for DTP members' kids. Ovik felt layers of discomfort with being assigned this. He had no experience in designing academic curricula or teaching of any kind, so he felt very out of his depth and had no one advising him who to talk to, who he could consult with, how he could go about doing this. And he was made even more uncomfortable when he was pressured to skirt zoning codes. The Learning Village was always said to be a permanent fixture in the DTP area, but he was encouraged to apply for a temporary license to construct it, to start the project. So he was encouraged to take the easy, quicker, maybe less scrutinized route of applying for a temporary permit for a project he knew to be not temporary. He proposed some changes that he thought would help other struggling members of the DTP too, including regular group meetups to answer each other's questions. Tony's emailed response was a detailed one, but much vaguer than the detailed list of concerns in Ovik's original email. He argued, yes, you're welcome to start a meeting series, but that's on you if you want to. He said, if you want to get more consultations, go ahead and get them. Basically not offering concrete ideas as much as saying, yeah, go for it. You have permission. He also said, look, this transition is going to take a while. We're still in an awkward training wheels phase. Hang in there. The kinks will work themselves out in due time. Quote, once we get Holacracy up and running, then many of the issues will be addressed, unquote. Andrew Donner, a real estate partner of Tony's, later argued that no one pressured Ovik to skirt zoning codes, and it's just that the nature of the project genuinely changed. He wasn't cutting corners, he was genuinely seeking a temporary permit, which others dispute. But regardless, Ovik was very emotionally struggling to live with the guilt of knowingly doing that. January 6th, 2014, at age 24, Ovik was found dead after jumping off an apartment balcony. Adding insult to injury, when Ovik's parents arrived, they realized police had at first misidentified his body. This really led to another round of severe soul-searching for DTP participants, four of whom ended up quitting. Ovik had emailed kind of a cry for help, for some direction, and ironically a sense of community that was lacking in the pursuit of individual management. One DTP member likened the situation to a journalist of an Ayn Rand one. The philosopher Ayn Rand basically advocated individualism in a way that seemed to totally forget the inherent connections and collective traits that contribute to a full life. It was kind of just on them to start whatever mental health care in the wake of Ovik's passing they felt like was needed. So ideas really were spitballed all over the place, from starting a church there to creating a crisis hotline. Turntable Health, their health clinic, did announce they would officially hire a full-time psychiatrist. Turntable Health employed this doctor who was known to try to keep things happy and quirky in a way, with medical rap-themed music videos like Manhood in the Mirror. There was an odd mix of serious and unserious undertones. Mark Rowland, of Rocketeer fame, was tasked with being the official cheerleader of the response. Addressing the fallout of this was extra rough for him because he himself had had a dark suicidal moment after a life-changing deal fell through. An investor offered $10 million to help keep his company, StyleTread, above water. At the last minute, the deal didn't pan out, so Mark was faced with both financial ruin, the inventory he would have to buy, the way he used his house as collateral for the deal without telling his wife. He put it all on the line. But there was also future funding implicated by this reputational damage, and he'd have to lay off 70 people he cared about. He felt a huge identity crisis at the thought of losing his company, which speaks to these bigger themes of sorrow and stress of entrepreneurs. You're always living one deal cancellation away from disaster, and professional disaster often feels like personal disaster because your identity becomes wound up in the company you are famous for, moved to a new place for, and you changed your whole life for. They added to the dark thoughts of other employees there. I mean, they got up and left their lives to move to Vegas for this, so they really didn't have their typical support system or a new one replacing it when they moved to downtown Vegas. They were uprooted, and it was hard to know who would help them plant down new roots. Tony did make sure that anyone who wanted to go to Ovik's funeral could. It wasn't a work issue. He also financially contributed to funeral services, and he brought in a new therapist, Kimberly Knoll, but he seemed again to want other people to handle the icky emotions. He was in charge of giving people happiness. He didn't want to be a part of other emotions, but as Kimberly Knoll put it, quote, "If we negate the negative emotions in our lives, it takes us away from happiness and brings around shame. The whole idea of downtown is grand and wonderful and purposeful. But sometimes the way we're going about it isn't psychologically healthy," unquote. One reporter had a line of questioning for Tony because, I mean, over the course of just 16 months, 3 DTP members committed suicide. 2 officially, 1 presumed. The third was Bolt Barber's founder, Matt Berman, who had struggled with both understaffing and rude customers, to put it mildly. The reporter recalled, quote, "My question appeared to make him uncomfortable. He scooted 2 seats away," unquote. Tony sent an email with ideas for how they could look out for each other's well-being in the wake of Ovik's death, but one of the ideas that was pursued regarding employee wellness was scuttled after they realized how much it would cost. Tony also repeatedly responded to press inquiries about this stuff with things like, quote, "Suicides happen anywhere. Look at the stats," unquote. He often did bring up the numbers, like 3 people over 16 months, but on average for Vegas, not too different than other parts of Vegas. He tried to put it into a statistical perspective. "I understand there are times where emotional processing is on the back burner and we approach a situation through stats and cold hard numbers and non-emotional parts of it. So times we come across as so cold and unfeeling could be cold. I don't think he handled this well, frankly, but it's not like a malicious thing. It's more of a how we're wired thing. We're used to staying on the periphery of situations that trigger emotions, preferring to focus on logical context. So we kind of shy away from, don't know how to process the emotional stuff, at least in public. Our public-facing selves avoid emotional implications sometimes. So that doesn't mean he didn't feel for Ovik or feel responsible for Ovik's despair and not addressing it fully, but that's just not the stuff he would show publicly. So I have empathy for Tony, maybe more than most. However, again, really, really concerning the lack of handling this situation that speaks to larger trends in the tech world, the entrepreneur world. A variety of other notable events in 2014. The Zappos call center operators, the core essence of the mission, the personification of the joy Zappos preached, had lost some of that joy. They weren't picking up shifts as excitedly as they used to, and some people actually, who used to never do this, were calling in sick. Some people departed the project feeling like it really lost its way, wasn't getting this, how big of an issue these suicides should have been, and how the need needed to go away from prioritizing a holacracy shift and instead focusing on mental health resources, helping the people already there, and the systems already working. One longtime enthusiast confided in a reporter, quote, "Giving a tour through Tony's apartment is like giving a tour in North Korea. It's like how they fill their hotels with people, and then they disappear once the tour is over. That's how I feel, and I can't do it anymore," unquote. David Gold wrote a letter to Tony saying, quote, "I left my home to follow you. There were heroes among us, and it is for them that my soul weeps," unquote. Zach Ware cited part of the issue he had with a company, Shift, was not moving farther away, but he felt so compelled and so loyal to his big financial backer, Tony, that he was feeling obligated to stay by his side. As mentioned before, the times people try the hardest to cheer up sometimes are the times they're the saddest or most desperate for something. 2014 saw a somewhat surprising and hard to explain rise in nitrous oxide usage as a drug of choice recreationally. Let's pause here and get ready for the next chapter of this story, coming very soon. Be sure you're subscribed so you don't miss it.